How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Listen carefully to this clip, and you can make out the sounds of two men, one of whom is the legendary actor Charlie Chaplin, slapping each other in the face for comedic effect. Chaplin, known for the slapstick humour of his films, was part of a generation of actors who managed to continue working through the transition from the era of silent film to one filled with dialogue and sound. The introduction of sound wasn't the only way that people revolutionised cinema, and it won't be the last. So what does the history of cinema tell us about the evolution of technology in the arts?
Moving images are just pervasive. It's the one art form, I think, that people are involved with every day. You know, people are looking at and sharing and making moving images every single day. So it's the most important art form, I think, of our time.
Some researchers exploring how technology can continue to change the film-watching experience are looking at ways that audiences can change that experience, influencing what they see on screen with their thoughts. How can brain activity be used to change the plot of a film? And is there a place for the traditionally passive experience of watching a film to become more interactive? Or will that detract from what we value about cinema?
In the future, audiences will have the opportunity to immerse themselves in a collective experience of controlling an interactive film.
This is Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. How long have you worked at the Museum of the Moving Image?
Since 1985.
Wow.
Long time. Actually, we opened...
David Schwartz is the chief curator at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York, where I called him up on Skype.
Our core exhibition is called Behind the Screen, and it looks at the whole process and world behind production and exhibition and distribution for movies and television.
David explained that the original motivation for the creation of moving images as we know them today wasn't really for entertainment, but for science.
You know, the history goes back actually even before the 19th century. You know, there were forms like the magic lantern. There were all these forms of what we now call pre-cinema, where there was an impulse to make images move. But really in the late 1800s, you had photographers like Edward Muybridge in America and Etienne Jules Marais in France, who mainly had a scientific interest. They wanted to study the movement of animals and people. So they invented cameras that could take a series of still images, and then you could analyze motion. So that interest was there, and that naturally led to the evolution of cinema. I mean, I think there was just an impulse to capture reality and record it and share it. But I think there's a pretty common agreement that the movies as we understand them and as we experience them really started in 1895 with the Lumiere brothers. They were French photographers who invented a camera, a machine called the cinematograph, which was a combination of a camera and a projector. And so they could record motion pictures and then present the motion pictures projected onto a large screen to a paying audience. And that started in 1895.
What would it have been like to be in that audience, one of the first people to watch a film? What would they have been watching and what would the experience have been like?
The Lumiere Brothers films were, you know, roughly between 40 seconds and a minute long. And they recorded just bits of reality. You know, I think the most famous of the early films was the arrival of a train at a station in La Ciotat in France. So audiences saw a train platform at a station and a train coming in. You know, there was the sort of mythology was that audiences screamed in terror because they thought a real train was coming towards them. Now, that's, of course, not really what was happening with the audience. I think the audience was just excited when they realized what this machine could do.
What did the equipment look like that made these very early films, that filmed the, you know, the train arriving at the station?
There are not that many of them in existence in the world. And it's basically a box with a lens. It looks like a very simple camera. It was fairly portable. You know, there would be a tripod and this sort of square-shaped box that was a few inches thick, and a lens and a crank. So it's a very easy machine to move around. You know, fundamentally, the technology of cinema didn't change a lot in its early years. I mean, the cameras got bigger and they could hold more film, but basically these were boxes with strips of film running through. It was a very mechanical art form.
One of the most obvious changes in cinema came when the historically black and white images began to gain some color.
You know, the first color films were actually hand painted. So people, usually women in factory type settings, would literally paint on the film strip to add color. And so you would get what were essentially like tinted films, and they could be quite beautiful, but it was not a realistic color. It was very colorful and decorative. And color technology evolved into the 1930s, and then we finally in the 30s had the breakthrough of Technicolor film that we associate with movies like Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
In that process, you literally have colored dye printed onto the film strip. You have black and white film, and then colored dye is added, and you get a very brilliant color. It was an expensive process, so Technicolor was replaced by less expensive forms of color, but color really became the standard by the late 1950s, early 1960s. And by the 60s, almost every film was in color unless there was an artistic choice to do black and white.
And then there was sound.
The advent of sound was a real turning point. It was really the release of the jazz singer in 1927.
Blue sky, smiling at me.
Starring Al Jolson, it was basically a silent film that had some synchronized sound sequences. And in those early films, that early process in sound, the soundtrack was actually on a disc. It was separate from the film. The projectionist would play the film and then at the same time have essentially a turntable running with the soundtrack. And he would have to make sure they were synchronized. It took a few years before they perfected a process where the sound could be on the film. And with the advent of sound, you also had, also what was standardized was the speed at which a film runs through a projector. The camera person would actually crank the camera and could choose a different speed, and then the projectionist could play the film at different speeds. But when you had sound, you had to have a standard, so 24 frames per second became the standard.
I'm part of the Netflix generation. But the entertainment I enjoy obviously owes a lot to the invention of the television. And so too does cinema.
Where the most valuable piece of furniture is the television set. And the popular local jest is that the only real emergency telephone calls go to the family doctor or the TV repairman.
You know, the next two big revolutions in technology, one was in the 1950s when you had the advent of widescreen cinema, when television was introduced in the late 1940s, and Hollywood realized that it was competing with television for audiences. So you saw the birth of CinemaScope and widescreen.
Of course, not every big development in the history of cinema has had the same impact.
You know, I think in the 1950s, there were sort of crude forms of 3D, where audiences would wear glasses with red and blue filters. And in the early forms of 3D, you actually needed two projectors linked together. So you would have the film running on two separate movie projectors. It was fun. It was sort of a gimmick, but it didn't really work. It wasn't really vivid. I mean, you didn't really get vivid 3D until digital cinema came along. Now it's very common to have very good 3D.
In your opinion, putting aside the cinematograph, what would you say has been the most influential technology in the entire history of cinema?
You know, right now I have to say the advent of the computer in the moving image. I mean, I think it's changed everything. Every step of the filmmaking process now is digital, you know, is computer-based. So that includes editing, special effects, creating a soundtrack, and photography. You know, the cameras now are digital. So everything about how films are made is based in, you know, using computers and using digital technology.
Cinema has changed a lot in the last century. So what next? How will the technologists of today improve on the film-watching experience? After the break, we'll look at new research into how brain-computer interface technology can be combined with interactive cinema to make the audience feel far more involved in the film-watching experience.
Instead of just sitting and passively viewing a film, audiences will be empowered to collectively engage, maybe collaborate or compete, controlling aspects of the films like the plot we mentioned, or something more passive like the sound and the colors.
We'll be right back.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
This week, the world's first IVF baby turns 40.
The jar we're looking at is called a desiccator, and it's what the Petri dish sits in. It keeps it at body temperature so that the sperm and the egg in the Petri dish can do their thing and sort of meet up, really. But it's very weird looking at it, because just to think that my life started in that, it's just very weird.
Louise Brown was born on the 25th of July 1978, weighing 5 pounds 12 ounces. IVF has come a long way since then and is now pretty commonplace, with 68,000 cycles in the UK in 2016. But should we be concerned with the rising rates of fertility treatments?
There is some interesting data out there which suggests that sperm quality has declined over the last 50 or 60 years.
Join me, Hannah Devlin, on The Guardian Science Weekly. Just search for Science Weekly on your podcast app or head over to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. Before the break, we took a trip through history with the chief curator of the Museum of the Moving Image in New York to look at some of the biggest technological inventions that helped shape film. When the Lumiere brothers first came up with the cinematograph, people probably found the big brown box quite strange. But more than a century later, cinema is huge. But is there room for further improvement? What about if we turn this traditionally passive pastime into something the audience can impact themselves?
I'm Dr. Paulina Zioga. I'm a lecturer and researcher at Staffordshire University and the director of Interactive Filmmaking Lab.
Can you tell me about this Interactive Filmmaking Lab? So what do you do there on a kind of day-to-day basis?
Well, the Interactive Filmmaking Lab is a newly established group bringing together researchers from Staffordshire universities together with external collaborators who work on expanded cinema and experimental filmmaking that goes beyond what is the mainstream two-dimensional viewing of a film, and it often involves the use of interactive technologies. So we are focusing more on interactive filmmaking and media from a creative but also technological and scientific aspect. So
the idea of interactive film isn't new.
Interactive filmmaking and interactive technologies for cinema actually go back to the 1960s when we had the first production of an interactive film called Kino Automat, at the time, country of Czechoslovakia. What has changed in recent years is that we have new technologies that, for example, have been developed, but in the process they started being explored by researchers and individual filmmakers for their potential for cinema. Virtual reality nowadays has led to the introduction of special sections in major international festivals, and its potential has also been acknowledged by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
How does somebody control what happens in the film with their brain then?
So the way these devices work is by using techniques like electroencephalography.
So that's when they put the things on your head, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So these devices have sensors that can be attached to different positions on the head, such as the forehead of the person wearing them, and they record the electrical activity of the brain along the scalp. Then the data of this activity can be transmitted to a computer where the signal can be analyzed in order to extract certain features. One example is the different frequency bands of the electrical signal of the brain that are associated to different brain and cognitive states. A brief example, we have theta frequency band that is associated to a relaxed state. We have alpha band that is associated to quiet wakefulness. Beta is more dominant when we are consciously awake and focusing. And gamma is related to more intense mental activity and tension. Extracting this information, we can use it to control different outputs. So, for example, in the frame of a film, if we measure that the person wearing the device is becoming less engaged, maybe the plot and the narrative of the film will not progress, will not move forward until the person focuses again.
Paulina recently teamed up with the digital design studio of the Glasgow School of Art, among many others, to produce a live cinema performance that used this BCI technology. Enhedwana, a manifesto of falling.
It is a live cinema event, so apart from the projected film moving image, we can have one or more live elements. For example, the live act of performers, live electronics, and of course the live interactive film. And that is combined with a brain-computer interface system, essentially headsets that can be worn by the performers and the audience in order for them to be able to control through their brain activity aspects of the event, like the moving image.
Okay, so the fact that it's the first one used with multiple brains. So you've said there you've got the performers and the viewers are wearing these headsets. How does that work then? Does it kind of combine all of the signals from all of these people, or does it use them individually?
So in that case, what we did is that we divided the work into two parts. The first part is a part where audience is introduced in the story. And the film is controlled only by the actor's brain activity. The second part starts with a film being controlled only by the audience's brain activity, and in the process towards the end, the film is controlled by the merged brain activity of the audience and the actress. Now, how exactly we did this, we use the headsets that I mentioned before. And in terms of extracting the information of the brain activity and their cognitive state, we map the different frequency bands and the power of them to different colors. So, for example, we mapped their band that is associated to a more relaxed state to the color of blue, the one that is associated to more focused, awake state was mapped to green, and the states that were more stressed or emotionally engaged were mapped to the red. Then we would combine these three colors, and that would create in real time a constantly changing color that was applied to the film that was originally in black and white. And this way, the atmosphere of the narrative, but also the entire event, was set by the cognitive, the brain state and activity of the audience and the performer.
This was obviously a really experimental performance. What did you learn from it, and how are you going to take that forward?
This work enabled us, apart from designing a new system for facilitating the interaction, also to collect a lot of valuable data, both neuroscientific as well as behavior. And the results showed us that the majority of the audience were able to identify when the brain activity was controlling the film. It also showed that they tended to be more attentive when the brain activity was interacting, and that was during the second part I mentioned before. Whereas when the brain activity was merged with a performance, they were more emotionally engaged. So I think in essence that showed us that applying brain-computer interaction for cinema, but also other interactive technologies, personalizes the experience of the viewer, makes it more special and meaningful for them, and also makes them more attentive and emotionally engaged.
Using brain-computer interface in interactive cinema may add another level to an audience's experience, but does it also risk taking something away? I go to the cinema to relax, to get away from things in my life that require my input, and to passively absorb somebody else's story. Does this new kind of interactive experience require active participation from the audience? And if so, can it really catch on?
If we look back at the history of cinema and film, the experience of watching a film was always augmented in one way or another. So in the silent film era, viewers would watch the film together with live music. Then we had the invention of the TV and the introduction of the VCR that enable people to watch films at their home and using the remote control, pause, start, rewind, move forward the film as they please. So I think these technologies are part of the history and evolution of cinematic experience. It will probably create new type of experience, new types of creativity for cinema, and add to the options of the audience.
How do you feel about this notion of interactive cinema then, whether it's using these brain waves or not? Do you like the idea, or does it kind of put you off?
On an aesthetic level, I mean, I tend to be a bit old-fashioned. I tend to like the idea that the artist or the filmmaker creates a story and I go and watch it and experience it and think about it and respond to it. And I feel like that's interactive enough. But at the same time, we're in this incredible period of very rapid change. And I think exciting forms are emerging. So I think we all need to be open to that.
I'd like to thank David Schwartz and Dr. Polina Zioga for joining me this week. We'll have a link to the Museum of the Moving Image and to Polina's live brain-computer cinema performance research on this week's episode description on the Guardian website. Don't forget, you can send me an email at chipspodcast@theguardian.com with any questions or ideas you might have. That's all for this week. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.